are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, January 28th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Now on the program today, the impeachers, the trial of Andrew Johnson, and the dream of a just nation. Professor Brenda Wineapple will be joining us. Also on the program today, Republicans plot to ignore the Bolton bombshell as the Dersh argues it's not abuse of power when the president does it. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court okays expansion of public charge, coincidentally on the Holocaust Memorial Day. And that public charge policy also coincidentally once used to deny Jewish refugees from Europe during said Holocaust. Meanwhile, Washington Post suspends a reporter for tweeting a three-year-old story or article on Kobe Bryant's rape charge. Doug Collins to run in the Georgia Senate jungle primary, further pushing the implications of impeachment on these vulnerable Republican senators. House Democrats plan to pass a bill to strike down Trump's travel ban. It will die in the Senate. Netanyahu drops his immunity bid as criminal proceedings on fraud and bribery move forward. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is a relatively slow news day today because we only have the impeachment trial continuing. We only have the fallout from the Bolton leaks yesterday and the scurrying around of Republican senators trying to figure out this Rubik's Cube of how they're going to avoid losing the Senate because of they're turning this into a sham trial. And of course, you may not be aware, there is the first in the nation Democratic caucus slash primary will be taking place exactly 1 week from yesterday.
Bring it on.
There you go. Polls are starting to, back and forth. There's a little bit of narrowing. There's a lot of freaking out about Bernie Sanders. They have deployed all of the mainstays of the establishment media are finally recognizing that Bernie Sanders is actually a contender in this primary. And they think that, I don't know. I mean, we all like to think we have butterfly wings and that we will do something. We'll talk more about both David Frum's piece and now Jonathan Chait's piece.
Oh my God, so good. I read it this morning. He's losing his shit.
It's really not terribly different. I don't think, I mean, this has been an ongoing rinse and repeat type of situation for Chait for 15 years, as far as I can tell.
I hate to see it.
Actually, I it makes me feel like at least gravity still exists. And we will probably go through both those pieces tomorrow. Maybe we'll hit Jennifer Rubin's piece too. I mean, it is stunning how hilarious it is that people who constructed a political party, theoretically, the people who were the intellectual pillars of the Republican Party, the guy who was the chief speechwriter for George W. Bush, the columnist who was the perhaps the biggest supporter of Mitt Romney in 2012, at least in the mainstream press, the guy who encouraged and maybe single-handedly made it possible for John McCain to pick Sarah Palin. Though I haven't heard much from Bill Kristol lately. Is he sick or something? I don't know. I haven't, has he been around much? But these people who basically spent their professional careers stitching together like tailors a suit that was perfectly measured to Donald Trump's measurements so that he could just walk on stage and slide right into it. They're the ones who are suggesting that they know and should be in a position to tell the Democratic Party who they should elect and who they should vote for and who they should support. It's hilarious, but for the horror show that we have in our politics that has been created by these people. I mean, I haven't dug into it. Maybe folks out there can do it. But I'd be curious as to how hard Jennifer Rubin slammed Mitt Romney when he went to literally kiss Donald Trump's ring to get his blessing to run in 2012. I would be curious as to how many pieces Bill Kristol has written that say, you know, if I understood that Sarah Palin, that there would be a direct line between her and Donald Trump, maybe if I had to do it all over again, I would do it a little bit different. I wonder if David Frum, when he was developing the speeches to lie this country into war, and we just did a story the other day about Guantanamo, and there's stories in the news about the so-called enhanced interrogation program that they just tried out on a practice prisoner. I mean, these people, I mean, it's hard to put blame, right? I mean, it's hard to say that any individual or any group of individuals is responsible for the trajectory of history and politics. But if it's possible, if there is any influence that is exerted by any of us, me in this tiny little show, them on their, you know, various media perches, they're responsible for Donald Trump, certainly as much as any single voter is, because their job was to encourage thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of voters to vote for Donald Trump, to create this scenario, to construct our politics so that it's like this. I mean, give me a break. You want to go and opine, make a couple of bucks, God bless you. But nobody can possibly take these people seriously in terms of who Democrats should vote for. In fact, I mean, look, outside of using them to hammer Donald Trump, and I've made it quite clear over the past 3 or 4 years that I also think it's fairly useless because they have no constituency. If they had a constituency, they would be talking to them instead of Democrats. They would turn to their constituency and say, hey, hopefully they don't nominate someone who's really going to, you know, make it hard for us to vote against Donald Trump. But regardless of what happens, we're going to vote against Donald Trump, right? But that's not the game that they're playing. because they don't have a constituency. If they did, Donald Trump wouldn't be the nominee. It would have been their team that would go on to do these horrid things, not his team. Same policy prescriptions. So it's pretty funny seeing this. And, you know, Jonathan Chait has been wrong about some of the biggest stuff that we can talk about in politics over the years.
Yeah, the fact that that guy is still employed as any form of liberal pundit is a crime.
Here is the one. This is the one. Tweet?
I'm not sure if it's the one. She tweets a lot about Romney, but I was looking for her tweeting about Trump around the time. And it looks like she was defending Romney.
Yes. There we go. We don't have the original tweet. Yeah. It's hard to know. But she says, the only good news for Romney is that for a while, Trump won't be threatening to run as a third party candidate. Now, I don't know if that's in response. February 2012 could have been in response to him going and kissing the ring.
That's why I went back to February 2nd, because that was the day that
He did that.
Kissed the ring.
And so that's it. That was it. That was it.
That worked out well.
Yeah.
I really did enjoy that cucktastic photo of them together, though.
Yeah. But Romney was, and I remember that day. I remember saying, like, how messed up is the Republican Party that this guy's a kingmaker? All right. Well, folks, let's turn to... a little segment that we're doing for the first time and probably the last time, because I don't like doing little rollout packages. But I don't like to brand segments. I just don't like to do it. But we're going to do it for now. Life comes at you fast, folks. Here is Lou Dobbs. This was about a year ago, right? March 20th. And here it is, Lou Dobbs singing the praises of, and I remember the night this lunatic was appointed to the Trump administration. In fact, I was on Ari Melber's show, and they had some Republican, another one of these never Trumpers coming on. Well, at least John Bolton is, he's a mainstream Republican foreign policy guy. No one apparently knew that even a Republican Senate would not confirm this guy during the Bush years. And he had to get appointed in a recess appointment by George Bush to the UN. But here was John Bolton Lou Dobbs super psyched about John Bolton in March of this year, of last year.
Top story tonight, the newest Trump administration shakeup. National Security Advisor in General H.R. McMaster is leaving the White House. The president announced on Twitter, quote, I am pleased to announce that effective April 9th, Ambassador John Bolton will be my new National Security Advisor. I'm very thankful for the service of General H.R. McMaster, who's done an outstanding job and will always remain my friend. There will be official contact handover on April 9th. Our first guest tonight was Ambassador Bolton's chief of staff during his time as ambassador to the United Nations. Fred Flights joins us tonight. Fred, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Lou.
This is a friend of mine put it, a great day for the America and as well
the America?
For the president.
It is a great day. John Bolton is a friend. I supported him as an intelligence officer on two occasions. I was actually his chief of staff when he was Undersecretary of State for Arms Control.
Yeah, there you go. And I mean, it's a great day for the America. But of course, those great days, sometimes they end.
And super PACs, by the way, we should point out, have more than $2 million in cash on hand. His major donors are Romney supporters and, well, many of them never Trumpers. The top three donors, Robert Mercer, Richard Uihlein, Warren Stevens, spent millions supporting Romney
pause
in 2012.
Pause it. We should tell you that Robert Mercer spent millions of dollars to get Donald Trump elected. In fact, he and his sister spent like the first year. It was almost like they lived at the White House until Bannon left. But apparently now Lou Dobbs is digging into who's giving money to John Bolton's super PAC. Interesting.
Robert Mercer, Richard Uihlein, Warren Stevens spent millions supporting Romney in 2012 and opposing Trump in 2016. See how it works?
You bet. Not so complicated, is it? John Bolton himself has been reduced to a tool for the radical Dems and the deep state with his, well, his allegation that the president once told him that the aid to the Ukraine was entirely dependent on whether or not Mr. Zelensky carried out investigations of his political opponents. Bolton's book agency, Javelin, has published books by disgruntled current and former government officials such as, well, former fired FBI Director James Comey, the anonymous Trump administration official who wrote the book A Warning, and Cliff Sims, a former White House staffer who the president said broke a non-disclosure agreement to write a book bashing the White House. Do you see the pattern here with Mr. Bolton? And Javelin partners bragged to the New York Times about their approach. Quote, we've met with or talked to probably every major official you would know who has departed or is thinking of departing the Trump White House.
Wow. Where was the, doesn't he have a straight line to also to Mitt Romney? Doesn't he have a graph? Do we have any more of that? There it is, Mitt Romney. I mean, excuse me, John Bolton. It's all, he's got allegations. You know what I love about Lou Dobbs is his very light touch on his sarcastic, his little sarcastic thing where he's like, it's allegations.
He uses sarcasm to get over when he misspeaks weirdly. He's like, I'm being sarcastic right now. I'm not slurring my speech.
Exactly. But there you have it. It's very, very simple. Incidentally, Mercer corrected. Bolton was appointed in 2018. So, you know, it has been a year and a half to deal with that. Mercer gave Trump $15 million. And here's Romney's ties to Bolton. it's sort of weird as to why you have all these other like why this has to be such a diagram. Like Romney goes directly to Bolton. It's at there's who doesn't? Oh,
there's not a line.
There's
between
no
them.
Tie between the brothers, which is the most mysterious thing of all.
Oh, that's right. That's weird. The brothers are not connected at all.
Suspicious, don't you think?
And where's Robert O'Brien? That's not the guy he had on his show a year ago, was it?
It's like one of those hookup maps you pass around at middle school.
Sort of, except for like, shouldn't Romney like Romney's ties to Bolton are just direct. What's the other three people in there doing?
Wouldn't you like to know?
I mean, they want to use those two pictures of the Vindmans, obviously.
Incidentally, those are the only three other people that John Bolton knows. That's why. They do the direct tie to Romney, and then Bolton just knows three other guys. And we might as well throw them all in there. We can collect the whole thing.
Where are the radical Dems on that map?
You mean the radical Dems?
It seems like a bit of a leap.
That's true.
Yes, indeed.
Where are the radical Dems? How does he connect to them? It's very strange.
Yeah, they were nowhere.
We better do another hour-long report on this. So now it's being reported. Look, the Republicans, well, I'll talk about this later in the program, but the long and short of it is the Republicans are desperate to figure out how they're going to get out of this jam. They can offer this one-for-one deal, but the weird thing about it, and Chuck Schumer's doing a bad job communicating this, they don't need to make a one-for-one deal. If they want to call the Bidens, they can call the Bidens. All they need is 51 votes. They have the votes to do it. They can call whoever they want. The issue isn't whether they can call the Bidens. Chuck Schumer should be up there like, we're not in a position to accept or deny a deal like that because you guys are the ones making the votes. We're just asking, will you call John Bolton? Why won't you call John Bolton? And I thought the way they would end up doing it would be to do like a secret meeting with John Bolton. But the problem with that is that people come out of there and they start talking about it. So I think supposedly what they're going to do now is people are going to have access, secret access to the manuscript. That's what they're going to try and push, I think. And that way there can be no more revelations that come out. I've looked at the manuscript and it doesn't say what the New York Times said it said. And then other people are going to come out and say, it does say that. but we weren't allowed to write down anything. We weren't allowed to take any pictures of it. And then it just comes out. Now it's like, we don't really know. When the manuscript comes out, maybe they'll sue to keep the manuscript from coming out or something. Still evidence. Who knows? But they are worried about it. We will talk more about that as we go. Folks, half of Americans report they fight with daily fatigue. Guess what? Here's a surprise. I'm one of them. Liquid IV Energy Multiplier gives you sustained energy throughout the day. It's a great all-natural alternative to processed energy drinks. Ladies and gentlemen, just coincidentally, I was a little bit tired today. Boom. I've got this baby fired up for later in the second half of the show. It's got premium matcha and green energy blend. It tastes delicious. It really does. Look, it doesn't. I'm not going to say it looks like fantastic. It looks like algae, but it tastes great. And it provides a lasting energy boost for throughout the day. It's like a couple of cups of coffee without the crash. Liquid IV's energy multiplier contains a mixture of teas and herbs that are high in antioxidants and help improve mood and focus. I think you can tell, right? No artificial flavors, no artificial preservatives. The cellular transport technology, I don't know what that is, but I will tell you, it does. It works quickly. Rapid absorption into the bloodstream. It gives you the boost fast. It's non-GMO. It's vegan. It's free of gluten. It's free of dairy. It's free of soy. Free of all that garbage stuff. I love it. I really do. This is my favorite. This has gone to like my favorite go-to liquid IV. And that it was tough competition, folks. This office is in love with liquid IV. Look at that. Look at how quickly those boxes go. It's a little bit annoying. Get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order on Liquid IV's website. Just go to liquidiv.com. Enter the promo code MAJORITYREP to save 25% and get better hydration and energy. Don't wait. Start fueling your adventures today. Also, speaking of healthy, plant-based, non-toxic stuff, healthy plant-based to non-toxic cleaning products work. And the good ones, they're actually just far more pleasant to use. The problem is, where do you start? Who do you trust when you're picking this stuff out? That's where Grove Collaborative comes in. Grove Collaborative is the online marketplace. It delivers all-natural home, beauty, and personal care products, and they deliver it directly to you. Grove takes the guesswork out of going green because every Grove.co, it's Grove.co product, is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. Folks know I've got a whole array of Grove stuff. I mean, I have to say, the Mrs. Meyer's dish soap, it's pretty good. I get the lemon one. I can take that in terms of the scented. But I also, they have a Grove branded concentrated all natural cleaner. So you get the spray bottle, you put this stuff in, it's orange smelling. It's a pleasant smell. The stuff works great. I love it. And it's super helpful. They get a guide in the on the Grove site, grove.co, and it gives you just a sense of, like, you know, the high quality products they have. I love it. And right now you can join 500,000 people, families who trust Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier, plus shipping fast and free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/majority, you're going to get a free 5-piece cleaning set from Mrs. Meyer's and Grove. It's a $30 value. Go to grove.co/majority. Get this exclusive cleaning offer. That's grove.co/majority. And lastly, speaking of sustainable, this is our advertisers completely dominated my morning this morning. So you've heard me talk about Kariuma. They are sustainable sneakers. And folks are getting just more sensitive about wearing products that are going to be sustainable. There is apparently a big waiting list for Kariuma's low-impact kicks. 5,000 people deep. It is a DTC sustainable sneaker brand. Kariuma's high and low top styles, they're good looking, they're super comfortable, and they are consciously made. Kariuma shoes are brand new, but they come with that perfect broken in fit. They got the old school design, like my old Chuck Tees. But they have new school ethics, and frankly, they are significantly more comfortable. Their Oka and their Katiba sneakers are made with premium natural materials that are sourced responsibly. Plus, Kariuma just launched their 100% vegan and carbon neutral sneaker, the Ibi. The Ibi, rather. It's made with 3D bamboo knit and recycled PET green EVA outsoles made from sugar cane, a cork and organic Mamona oil insole, and recycled laces, threads, and labels. Pretty awesome. All their styles come with their signature, crazy, comfortable green insoles. And their packaging is made from recycled and 100% recyclable materials. And by purchasing carbon offsets, they create a shipping footprint balance of, you ready for this? Zero. If the pair doesn't fit you perfectly, you can return them for free of charge. Honestly, today I woke up and I was like, should I wear my Kariumas? I don't know. It's like a little bit too dirty outside. Now I'm getting like very protective of my sneakers, which is very odd for me. But I think, you know, I'm an adult. I'm wearing like adult sneaks. They're cool. And they're the only thing that my daughter says I wear that are in any way sort of fashionable, she says.
Well, Michael says you need a pair for wearing and a pair for looking fresh to death in. I don't know, like, in what context you look fresh to death if you're not wearing them, but that's what he says.
Well, see, my problem is I never have a moment where I need to look fresh to death. And so that's the problem. I get stuck. But right now, for a limited time, our listeners can get an exclusive 15% off your first pair of Kariuma sneakers. Go to Kariuma, Kariuma.com/majority to get 15% off. That's Kariuma, Kariuma.com/majority for 15% off today. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to be talking to Brenda Wineapple. She's the author of The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. I interviewed her yesterday. The book is fascinating. It's fantastic. And I think people know that I've got like this big, I'm trying to think of what a word is that's not inappropriate. Like, I'm excited about Reconstruction these days. And, I dropped my old, you know, the same metaphor that I've been using now half a dozen times. So, forgive me, but here's that interview now. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor MFA programs at Columbia University and the New School, and author of her latest, I should say, is The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. Brenda Wineapple, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So I have to tell you that your work has come up in the context of other conversations that we've had, writers that we've had on the show have referenced your book. And so I was very interested to check it out. And to be fair, I haven't gotten very far into it at all, but I plan to. It's I have become increasingly convinced that the era in which you're writing about the Reconstruction is both the most misunderstood, the least taught, it feels like, relative to how important it has been in creating America as we know it today, that it's in many respects our founding fathers were in this trial that you recount in your book. Just give me your sense of overall, like, why has Reconstruction been misunderstood, but also it just seems to me to almost erased up until fairly recently.
I completely agree with you, and in fact I so agree with you that it really my understanding or misunderstanding or lack of understanding of Reconstruction generally and specifically the impeachment trial of Andrew Johnson were what motivated me to write the book, because it occurred to me, and it was during the course of writing a previous book, that I really didn't know very much about this episode in American history, the impeachment, the first impeachment of an American president, and that it was so bound up with other things that were going on at the time, namely the end of the Civil War, you know, a terribly bloody, divisive struggle, you know, a slaughter, really, from many points of view, and also the first ever presidential assassination. And here you are at sort of the brink of reforming a nation. You've finally gotten rid of that institution of slavery. You have the opportunity to really make the Declaration of Independence come alive and be real. And so it seems like a crucial moment. That's where I agree with you. And I thought, how is it that I don't really know very much about this? And you know, it's interesting. Many people recently, because of current events, have quoted John Kennedy's Profiles in Courage, because one of those chapters is about a man named Edmund Ross who actually voted to keep Andrew Johnson in office. And one of the things that Kennedy says in that particular book, which was the reigning assumption, is that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson didn't really have much to do with national causes or with the health of the nation or the future of the nation. And you have to scratch your head at that, because just as you're saying, this is a foundational moment. It's as foundational as the framers and the writing of the Constitution, because again, it's a restart, if you will, of American government, and therefore literature and culture and everything else.
Yeah, it's a fascinating era. I mean, the only analogy that I think like I've been able to come up with is almost the change between what was considered sort of ancient Hebrew, ancient Judaism, and then how it became completely, the religion completely changed when they were, when it became rabbinic. And you know, we practice rabbinic Judaism today, but it's almost like the America that we practice today was formed during this era after the Civil War. And this was the existence of Johnson on some level was an incredible impediment. Let's set first for folks who don't know,
right?
Just tell us about Andrew Johnson. I mean, sure. I don't know that people understand how vice presidents were elected or why Johnson.
Let me just back up one second, because I just want to underline one of the points. You know, not so much about the change from, you know, ancient Hebrew to rabbinic Hebrew, but certainly about why we don't know very much. And I think that the underlying issue that we don't know very much about this period or about what happened in that impeachment has to do with race and racial issues. And so to go to your question about who is Andrew Johnson, many people have said to me, why is it that Abraham Lincoln, who was a Republican and the Republican Party had just been formed to protest the extension of slavery into the West, into the territories, why is it that Lincoln would put a Southern Democrat, the other party, on his ticket or allow that to be on the ticket? And the simple reason is that in 1864, Lincoln was afraid that he wouldn't be reelected, and he wanted to stay in office to finish the war and to make sure it finished in the ways that he wanted it to finish. And so he thought by balancing the ticket, and I'm sure he was happy with those who suggested Johnson. We don't know how much he really had his fingers on things, but that it would keep the border states, who were still waffling about the Confederacy versus the Union, keep them in line And it would show a kind of magnanimity on his part. What he didn't know was that he'd be assassinated. He didn't know that he'd win in the way, you know, because much of the war hadn't turned around. He certainly didn't know he'd be assassinated. And there we were. We had Andrew Johnson in the presidency. Now, at first people thought, oh, Johnson, he'll be fine because he was so powerfully for the Union. He was the only United States senator from the South to stand up in the Senate during, you know, when secession was starting and to say he was against the South seceding. But the reason was that he thought slavery was better protected in the Union. So Lincoln and the North really didn't care about his racial policies or his view of slavery. They wanted what he represented, which was a kind of courageous person who stood against the Confederacy and the breaking up of the Union. That's how he got on the ticket.
So to be clear, like that he, this is a guy who had resentment of the establishment of the South on some level, but was at the very least a white supremacist, and to the extent and to the extent that he had any skepticism of slavery, it was only because it was an institution of the aristocracy of the South, as it were.
Right, except he wasn't part of that. I mean, that's an important point. He wasn't part of the aristocracy. He didn't come from an old planter family. He was dirt poor, born in abject poverty, lost his father when he was pretty young. His mother sent him and his brother out to be apprentices, which meant that they really had no freedom, theoretically, till they were 21. And when he ran away, the tailor in whose shop Johnson was apprenticing actually put out a warrant for him as if he were, you know, a fugitive slave. I mean, it's just incredible. But as soon as he got some money, it's interesting that he bought slaves. So it wasn't that he was against slavery. I mean, this was a mark in the South, and I guess having arrived, owning other people, it's kind of inconceivable, but there you are. And so his position on slavery wasn't that he was against it. His position was it's better protected in the Union than outside of it.
And so,
which it may have been.
I mean, there's an analogy. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people making a lot of analogies to our current day. But there's a sort of what we call a never Trumper analogy, right? Like, mm-hmm. I don't like Donald Trump. I still like the entire palette of Republican policies.
Right.
I will be accepted by the opposition, what used to be the opposition, because we have a shared foe, I guess it is.
Right. Yeah, sure. Absolutely. You could say that in that particular way. And the shared foe were those people who were breaking up the Union. He was a unionist. He wanted the Union. But once he gets in office, even though he said those people who broke up the Union were traitors and traitors must be punished, all of a sudden now he's pardoning former Confederates. He's reestablishing Southern legislatures along the lines of white supremacy. Excuse me. And he's on, and it's alleged often that he said, this is a country of white men, and by God, it'll be a government of white men.
And to be clear, when you say once you get in office, you're talking about the presidency.
I mean, in the presidency, absolutely. Once Lincoln's dead in April 1865, Johnson takes the oath of office. Congress is not in session. He won't call it a special session. Oh. So he really begins the process of a so-called reconstruction. It's really more like a reconciliation with the South. And it's as if he wants to turn the clock back and make the South supreme again. The only thing is they'll abide by is the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery and which had been just almost finished to be ratified.
Okay,
so no more slavery.
So let's, before we take Johnson's role, let's set up the premise of the Republican Party at that time. And by the end of the war, what the I don't know if it's a wholesale name, but they're considered the radical Republicans because they want to take this opportunity. Right. This is sort of year zero type of situation. Talk about what their expectations were and what it meant to be radical Republicans. I mean, you know, and their program was extensive. I mean, it included things like public schools for people.
Something, you know, it was shocking.
Well, walk us through that.
In some cases, it actually included not all, but, you know, votes for women, but that's an outlier. Republicans at that time, as I mentioned, the party had started as basically an anti-slavery party, protesting the extension of slavery. And like most, even today, most political parties, there are divisions within the party itself. So there were moderate Republicans and conservatives, and then there was a group called radicals. And those particular radicals, they wanted the war, for example, prosecuted quickly and harshly. They wanted to make sure that slavery was abolished. They had urged Lincoln to, you know, delivered the Emancipation Proclamation even earlier than he did. So they were very clear that what they wanted was to eradicate slavery, everything associated with slavery, and then give people, and particularly the formerly enslaved of the South, an opportunity in terms of education, in terms of job training, because remember, education is important because slaves hadn't even been allowed to read and write. So that was the nub of the radical program. But it really, from one point of view, it wasn't so radical, from our point of view, certainly. But even to them, it wasn't, because initially all they wanted really was civil rights and citizenship for people like the formerly enslaved who'd been born in the United States and had been working there. Why shouldn't they be citizens? Why shouldn't they enjoy due process? Why shouldn't they be allowed to make contracts or travel freely or marry? I mean, it's just unthinkable in that sense. So that's what they were moving toward, and they were also, many of them, interested in political rights, too, for black men and women, particularly black men in the South, because remember, slaves had been counted as three-fifths of a person. Now that there was abolition and emancipation, these formerly enslaved are counted as full persons. But if they can't vote, then they have no representation in the government, you see. So they wanted to make sure people got political rights as well as civil rights. And Johnson vetoed or tried to stop or obstruct any kind of legislation that the radicals, and often the moderates too, because the moderates were for civil rights, and in fact the moderates and radicals joined together to hammer out the 14th Amendment, which would grant citizenship and due process. So that's what they were about. And again, it was to enshrine the values of the Declaration of Independence, that, you know, that everyone has an equal opportunity under the law for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And to what extent, I mean, go into their, I mean, that is sort of the programmatic vision for America going forward. Will you also just talk briefly, and you just touched on it a little bit, but I want to go a little deeper in it. Their programmatic vision for what has to happen with the Southern states, like what were the bars to entry, you know, what were the spoils? And I don't know that they would look at it, but what were the spoils that they thought were so important? And what is the relationship between the, you know, what they would take or what they would require of the South like how that would lead into the sort of their positive agenda?
Well, you know, again, just to back up a little bit, because sometimes we forget, you know, that the war is over, but you have 11 states in the South that has seceded. They basically said, we don't want any part of the Union. We're not part of it. We're going to form our own country called the Confederate States of America. So what do you do with them? That was the question. Do you just sort of say, oh, forget it. You know, yeah, war, we kill each other, but, you know, you didn't mean it. Come on back into Congress. Everything's forgiven. Well, the Republicans, and particularly the radical Republicans, said, not so fast. We have to sort of rebuild. We have to rebuild the South. We have to rebuild. We have to build schools. We have to build orphanages. We have to build roads. We have to figure out a way to make sure that all people are represented. So that was the kind of sort of centerpiece of the program going forward. Now, Johnson, to put him back in the equation, because he had such a free reign for so long and because he opposed the Republicans hook, line, and sinker wherever he could, when Congress had a majority, they started to say, well, we're going to put legislation in effect that makes sure there's due process, citizenship, even political rights. And in fact, in order to come back into the Union, one of the things that the South needs to do is enfranchise black men, let them vote, so that they can be part of the creation of new state legislatures. All right, so that's very, very important in that particular context. In order to do that, in order to sort of make this happen, Congress also passed laws that divided the South into five sort of zones, each of which was, you know, while they're getting their legislatures together and drawing up new constitutions and allowing black men to vote, these zones are overseen by military personnel. All right, so that's where things get really dicey with Johnson, because Johnson starts firing these military personnel. He tries to block this Reconstruction legislation that I'm talking about. And then, in fact, he fires the person sort of in charge of this largely, who's the Secretary of War. And there was legislation passed to protect that job so that he, the Secretary of War, could protect the military, so that the military could protect people, particularly black people, at the polls. Because there's one more element here that's really important. There was tremendous racial violence going on throughout the South at this particular time. And don't forget, the Ku Klux Klan is starting to form.
Okay, so let me just just backtrack just a little bit here.
Sorry.
The legislation. Well, no, I mean this is. I mean that's what's. You know, we're talking about what, like a 12-year period, and all of this is.
No, we're just 50... talking about a 3-year period.
Well, okay, right.
That's what's so interesting. It's only these 3 years. They're three teeny little years. You know, you can barely finish high school in 3 years.
Right. And all this happens, I mean, I can only imagine having done a YouTube show at that time and the amount of stories that would come in. But so we have this situation where the Congress passes this law to protect the Secretary of War. Because they are afraid of, because they sense at that point that Johnson is not with the program, that they're,
okay. But they more than sense it; they know it.
Okay,
now he's gone on a speaking tour. He has rallies basically in which he calls for the execution of his enemies. You know, these radical Republicans we were sort of mentioning before. He calls them out by name and says, yeah, they should be hanged, you know. And he also says, oh, they're persecuting me. And then he talks to leading Southerners and sort of whispers in their ear, don't ratify the 14th Amendment. And that's part of his rallying cry, too. So it's no secret, Johnson's point of view. No secret.
And so the Congress basically passes these laws to sort of head off. I mean, it's almost like the equivalent of, you know, what they tried to do recently in terms of like the sanctions against Russia. We're going to prevent the president from unraveling these things. At this time, the Republicans were trying to prevent all of the mechanisms, all the levers that Johnson could use, because once he, and this is important for people, I think it's hard for us to understand that you have these 11 states, the Union Army is now could have been, and in some instances was, like an occupying force, and could have, they could have chosen to say like, okay, I'm the prefect, I'm the area, and we're going to create an entire new civil administration here, and you're not allowed to run for office if you held office before above a certain amount, because you were part of a group of traitors who, basically created your own nation and walked away from ours. So we won, and we're going to come in and reconstruct it in that way. And they, to the extent that there was an attempt to do any of that, and I don't think it was, it's quite clear that, you know, Johnson wasn't going to go that far from the start. But to the extent that there was any Union forces in these states to protect former slaves, by firing the Secretary of War was basically a way of sort of saying like, okay, I'm gonna undercut the leadership chain here and just create a certain amount of chaos that will allow the existing institutions in these states to sort of reemerge.
Well, they wouldn't be allowed to reemerge exactly, because, you know, Congress is the body that makes the legislation. The president is supposed to execute it. You know, it's supposed to sort of put it in motion. But Congress passed these laws. These are laws on the books. You know, sort of, and so the South presumably, you know, has to accede to them and wants to get back in the Union. Congress, you know, is given through the Constitution the ability to determine the conditions of its own membership. So they have determined what it takes for these states to get back in. And actually, it's not that much. Ratify the 14th Amendment, you know, set up these new state constitutions that, you know, allow black men to vote, you know, on representation in that sense. The so-called occupying army or Union forces, you know, the word occupying kind of makes us all kind of stand up at attention and feel kind of anxious. That's what Southerners or backers of Johnson were saying. The military is occupying. Got to get rid of the military. That's, you know, we have a, you know, it's despotism. But it wasn't intended that way. It was provisional. It was only to guard people and make sure that the laws were executed and people weren't slaughtered anymore in the streets. So, and you can't have the police forces do that, because as in New Orleans, the police force was mainly former Confederate soldiers who had no problem killing not just black people, but white loyalists, white people who sort of were on their side. So it was a kind of chaotic time in that way. And as soon as these laws were affected, as soon as constitutions were reformed, as soon as there was vote, then these states could get right back in, and there wouldn't be, and that's what happened, because after Johnson is, you know, no longer president in 1868, there's a new election, Grant runs, and the states are allowed back in. They ratify the 14th Amendment. I mean, they want to get in. Nobody wants the military there very long. The military doesn't want to be there.
Right.
Besides, it's going to have other things to do, which is a whole other program. You know, it's got the West to deal with now, not the South, but that's another issue.
And at this point,
yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, I've realized we haven't talked about the impeachment, and at the very least, but I mean, I guess to a certain extent we have. I mean,
the
we have, insofar as we get a sense of. Part of the agenda, I mean, not the sort of like letter of the law agenda, but part of the impetus for Congress to feel like they are being thwarted, and the president is doing this in a way that is almost extra governmental on some level.
Oh yeah, definitely. He's usurping the power of Congress, and he actually said, I mean, this is unthinkable, really. He actually said Congress was illegitimate because it hadn't seceded the southern states. By that logic, you can't even have the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery because it was passed before the southern states were ceded. See what I mean? So he's really an outlier in that sense, at least from my reading and my point of view. And certainly, and many people, very, very radical, wanted to impeach Johnson before he was impeached. And, you know, sort of like today, people were saying, no, no, you know, not yet. Let's try to build bridges. Let's try to curb him with, you know, legislation that kind of makes sure we can rein him in. But when he violated this law, it was called the Tenure of Office Act, and that's a whole other sort of discussion, but when he violated it, all the investigations that hadn't led to impeachment fell by the wayside, and the House overwhelmingly voted to impeach because he was basically taking out his, you know, he was thumbing his nose at Congress and was saying, well, I don't have to listen to your laws. I don't have to. I can do what I want.
The Tenure of Office Act was the one that protected the Secretary of War.
Right, exactly.
And so, I mean, it was in the great scheme of things. I mean, I don't want to say it was a technicality because it was. He was simply ignoring a law passed by Congress. But relatively speaking, it, you know, when you talk about sort of fundamentally trying to prevent the country to reconstruct itself in the image of how the victors wanted it to, which has, you know, sort of like more. You know, people aren't walking around going like, ever since the Tenure of War Act was ignored, it has led to all this stuff. It's really all the other stuff that the Tenure of War stuff represented on some level. So let's talk about
that's like the straw that broke the, you know, back, and sort of the underlying causes. Go back to your initial question where we started the program. The underlying causes, you know, that Johnson was trying to take the country back to the 1830s, you know, back to slavery. Those underlying causes were swept under the rug in the 20th century, largely, you know, and it was, oh, this Tenure of Office Act, it was a technicality, it was unconstitutional, what a stupid thing to impeach somebody for. And that's why we didn't know anything about it.
I mean, it's as if 100 years from now, people are like, well, it was one phone call that Donald Trump made.
Exactly.
And there is no context in which this happened. So, I mean, you know, and we should say, like, there's only three, you know, we keep hearing the arguments like in the history of impeachment in this entire country, we've never seen anything like this. Aside from the fact that there's only been two other impeachments, we have seen almost something exactly like this.
I completely agree. I couldn't agree more. I mean, in a sense, the Clinton impeachment is kind of the outlier. In a way, because in that case, to go back to what I said, Kennedy said, the sort of fate of the nation wasn't at stake. The fate of democracy, the meaning of, you know, the separation of powers, all of those issues were not at stake in a perjury trial about, you know, tawdry matters, shall we say. But in 1868, the fate of the nation, the future of the nation, you know, Ed Charles Sumner, who was one of these radical Republicans in the Senate, and he got up and he said, this is one of the last battles with slavery. In other words, we're still battling slavery, but it's slavery by another name. Yeah, we have the 13th Amendment. But what about the effects of slavery? What about people's points of view? What about the way people are treated and represented in government? You know, so absolutely, there were the technical reason or the, what I said, the straw that broke the camel's back, all of that. Yeah, without a context, it makes no sense. But the context is everything.
To what material things did Johnson, I mean, is it possible to assess what material things Johnson actually precluded? In the, let's say we had not necessarily Lincoln, but and I don't know, you know, I don't know the, but let's say Lincoln had not been shot. I mean, and you know, I think that he certainly was probably, you know, the radical Republicans probably felt that, you know, throughout the war that he wasn't going hard enough in some respects.
Right.
I mean, he could be considered a moderate, let's say.
Right. I think so.
What would have been different? In other words, what did Johnson prevent that was within sort of even a moderate grasp in terms of where what this country could be going forward?
Well, what's interesting is what he tried to prevent, because fortunately, the opposition party, the Republicans, had the majority vote. So he tried to prevent civil rights. He tried to prevent, you know, equal opportunity. He tried to prevent, you mentioned, education. If Lincoln had lived, yes, probably the radicals would want to have pushed him farther, but they had pushed him, you know, they had pushed him, and he did listen. The thing about Lincoln was that he always listened. So if he was a moderate, moderates themselves joined together with radicals to create the 14th Amendment. I think there would have been a quicker reconstruction along lines of much more equality. Lincoln was already open. Part of the reason I think John Wilkes Booth was like driven nuts was Lincoln was already open to maybe giving what he said were some black men the vote, people who'd served in the army, for example. And so if he was open to that, you know, early on, in, say, March 1865, imagine what he would have been able to listen to. So perhaps then, if the South had been able to reenter Congress sooner and along fairer lines, maybe more money would have gotten to help rebuild parts of the South. Then after that, think of the people who could have gone down to the South to help rebuild schools, roads, you know, what we call today infrastructure. I mean, it really would have, and instead of those people that in the history books were called, you know, scallywags and carpetbaggers, you know, bad people from the North who came to rip off the South. So, you know, we don't know what would have happened. My sense is that my reading of Lincoln, my sense about Lincoln is, yeah, he wasn't as radical as the radicals, but he was a man who could change. He could listen. And he knew how to get things done. That's the other thing about Lincoln. He could get things done. He was a very pragmatic guy.
In terms of...
Who knows?
All right. Well, so I want to sort of end with this question, and it's sort of a big one a little bit. I mean, you know, and it's almost similar to the opening question as to why we know so little. Like, what, like, in many respects... Reconstruction in this era and this impeachment, which embodied that, you know, the sort of the struggle of that era. How much of it had to do with like this, the lost cause myth? How much it had to do with our inability to address or desire to avoid racial issues so that we didn't have to actually like meet the promise of what, you know, like, I mean, you know, we're talking. Following this, we have Jim Crow laws for decades upon decades after that. You know, it takes another almost 100 years until the vote is actually, you know, meaningfully protected. And we should say that meaningful protection has been undone by a Supreme Court that's very similar to one that existed, you know, around that era as well.
Exactly.
So, I mean...
I mean, you know, one of the people arguing against Jim Crow, you know, in separate but equal Plessy versus Ferguson happened to be this guy who was a radical Republican, you know. This was later in the century, of course. But you know, to go back to where we started, too, I would say, from my point of view, 100% was because of racial issues that we didn't know about what happened. It was because the sort of lost cause, sort of history writers, the lost cause terminology, the sense that, oh, those former slaves, they don't know anything, they can't really be in the legislature, they ruined everything, all of that kind of white supremacist rhetoric that you see, you know, forming in the late 19th century, certainly by the turn of the century, and you've got, you know, Klansmen, and you've got, you know, the recurrence or the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan, you've got Birth of a Nation. I think all of that worked together to bury really what was really a wonderful opportunity with people of vision who fought hard to make the country free and fair. And I think we don't know about what happened. We don't even know their names. And that's a real loss. And it shows not just a kind of historical amnesia, but a kind of historical prejudice, a prejudice of, you know, that I think was long with us. Probably the tide began to turn in the 1960s when you mentioned suddenly now we have real civil rights legislation, but it took 100 years. So, yeah.
It is.
I think that's what it's about.
The more I read about Reconstruction and things like the Lost Cause, which, you know, if I should just say for folks who, because I feel like there's just a tremendous dearth of awareness of this period. The Lost Cause was just the sort of the idea that, like, you know, this is about protecting a Southern culture. Much of what we heard about, you know, when we went through these taking down these statues of Confederate leaders,
right.
Sort of reinvoked all that stuff. It doesn't, nobody talks about it in that way so much, but it is fascinating how much this era mirrors the era following the Civil War.
Maybe we could learn something.
Well, that's a lot to ask. The book is
Hope Springs Eternal.
Indeed. Brenda Wineapple, the book is The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. We will put a link to this book at majority.fm. Again, Brenda Wineapple, thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, too. Thanks so much, Sam.
All right, folks. Can't recommend that book enough. Start to crack it. And a very important era. I think this came up actually with an interview I did with Carol Anderson on Wisconsin, the second time that we had her on, in regards to the similarities between what the Supreme Court was doing then and what it's doing now. And let's hope that we're not running a one-to-one repeat, because that would put us about 60 or 70 years out from cleaning up this mess. What if we're just on one big hamster wheel? That would sort of suck.
The flat circle?
Yeah. That would be a drag.
As McConaughey said.
The great philosopher.
Matthew McConaughey. Well, I mean, I think some of the work he's been doing on the Lincoln commercials really does resonate with me.
I saw the Harmony Korine movie he was in. Brendan, maybe you can remind me what the name of it is.
Gold Diggers or something?
It's a beach bum, yeah, where he's like a beach bum in Miami.
I have not seen that one.
Yeah, did you see Spring Breakers?
I did not see that one.
Brilliant film.
Okay. Yeah, well,
really captured the zeitgeist of late capitalism.
Beach bum is sort of similar.
I remember seeing the clips of Harmony Korine when he was going around trying to get people to beat him up. And shooting those videos. That was pretty cool. Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. We got so much going on right now. So much. First of all, the AMQ, the AM Quickie has been reborn. And we're improving it every single day. First of all, it's getting out the door by 8 a.m. easy. I think what we're going to do, I'm not sure. Maybe we'll see about that. Maybe put it, but we're getting a lot of feedback, appreciating both that we're getting it out earlier and that we've sort of tweaking it, and we're going to tweak it a little bit more. But it is a great way to start your day, get a sense of what the news is, so that you come in and it's done all within, you know, 5 or 6 minutes. You know, but I don't want to get any complaints like, oh, it was 5 minutes and 35 seconds. I don't want to hear that. But we try and make it tight. We try and give you the relevant facts, try and add a little bit of context too, so that you're not flying blind. And when you sign up for it, it just expands what we're doing here. We'll be able to sell ads against it, and we're not going to put more ads than are in it now, but we have one slot for ads, so 30 seconds. And you can sign up at amquickie.com. You can listen to it via our app at majorityapp.com, as long as well with the other with the Majority Report. So check that out. And remember, you can support the show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, and you become a member. We give you extra content. We are developing now a sort of a clean way of delivering. We're integrating video into our already existing membership system, so we don't have to do sort of links and link back to certain things behind other walls. And we're going to be doing a lot of special programming. The Iowa caucus live. We're going to be doing the State of the Union live. We're going to be doing the February 7 debate live. And at least the February 25th in Charleston. Maybe we'll do the Vegas one live. I might be doing that because I think I'm going to be on vacation with the kids at that point. But I may just hop on and figure out a way of just doing that one. But we're going to be providing a lot of live coverage over the next couple of months, 6 months, 10 months, whatever, until, you know, Donald Trump basically surrounds the White House with tanks. And if that happens, we'll cover that live too. And then, of course, we'll put it behind a paywall. So become a member, join the majorityreport.com. Also, don't forget TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS. You can go to the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Their show is going to be on Friday this week, right? Not Tuesday.
That is correct.
And I don't know. Other. And also check out Noma Key's show, the Noma Key Show, patreon.com/the Noma Key Show. Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, I have on Daniel Denver, host of Jacobins The Dig, a very excellent podcast, to talk about his new book, which is called All American Nativism, How the Bipartisan War on Immigrants Explains Politics as We Know It. Very modest subtitle there. I feel like the primary reason he wrote this book is because Trump's rabid xenophobia and anti-immigrant politics seem to come out of nowhere to a lot of people. But he traces the origins of this very far back into U.S. history. And it pays a special attention to the kind of bipartisan consensus around immigration that arose in the Bush, Clinton, and Obama years that really led directly to this horrible explosion that we're seeing now. We talk about that history. We talk about the material factors driving it. We talk about how Bernie Sanders should talk about borders and immigration and his very excellent immigration platform and how he's evolved on that. We talk about trade policy. We talk about how you can get involved. And we talk about some of the wrong ways to defend immigrants, right? It's not that they're going to work hard and contribute to the economy and get exploited by the bosses. It's that they're going to come here, join the labor movement as part of the international working class, and fight alongside native-born workers. So I'm very happy about this episode. Check it out. It's out tomorrow. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt.
I will not be here tomorrow because I will be putting the finishing touches on the second poem that I will have recorded. This is a poem by Ebenezer Cook, who wrote the last one, The Sotweed Factor, that I recorded. This is about Nathaniel Bacon and his rebellion. And what's interesting about Nathaniel Bacon and the rebellion is he was looked at as a rebel, and he wasn't a good guy until the American Revolution happened. Then it was like, oh, he was the first sort of guy who thought we could, you know, take on the monarchy. But anyway, he was a bad guy, really racist, mainly concerned with Indian hating. The thing we'll get into in the episode, patreon.com/literary hangover.
Why don't you do a real rebellion, a Shays rebellion?
Maybe we will.
Yeah, they marched into Worcester.
What year was that?
It's like 1780s.
Yeah, I'm like 100 years away from that.
You
still.
Guys going to have a rebellion
Whoa,
off?
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'm in the 1670s. Still.
That's great. That was one of the most boring centuries. 1600s.
Pretty important century.
I don't know. It's sort of boring. A little boring.
Where does it rank in your top 10?
I would say, like, even in it, I wouldn't even put it probably. I would probably put 1600 somewhere, probably like BCE. Like, you haven't come to like a more boring century.
Wow, that's fighting words.
I like 25,000 years ago.
That was all right.
It was lit.
I smell another podcast coming. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back. Back, 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 boys back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boys back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych!
Fuck them! Fuck them!
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
There, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Cannot hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy, total, 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 pussy.